If we just go to the ocean to enjoy the waves crashing on the beach, we're missing a lot because there's a whole lot more to the ocean. Stephen Palumbi, professor in marine sciences and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University, spent his professional life getting to know the ocean better and sharing what he's learned with the rest of us. He co-authored a book with his son Anthony called The Extreme Life of the Sea. Stephen will give a talk by that title on Friday at 6:30 at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. We get a chance to visit with him in advance. Dr. Palumbi, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on. Very, very much like it, and I'm looking forward to Coos Bay on Friday.
We're looking forward to having you there. I noticed that you lecture a fair amount on human-caused evolution, which causes a slight detour here. Was the UN Extinction Report out last week about what you expected to hear?
You know, it really was. I mean, that compilation of a million or so species at risk because of climate change comes as no surprise, unfortunately. That report was pretty terrestrial-based, and I just have to say that a lot of the same kinds of problems are going on in the ocean. Coral reefs people may have been hearing about in different news cycles, but also our own kelp forests along the West Coast are beginning to see how climate change is changing everything.
Let's start with the kelp forest then, because we've talked about that on the program before, and there's quite an ecosystem there that without the kelp goes not present.
Well, that's right. I mean, the kelp forest is like any other forest. The trees, that's the kelp plants, are sort of the architecture that lets all the other animals and plants live there. So without them, then you don't get any of the kinds of rockfish and bottomfish and lingcod that people really like to catch and take home with them. And the kelp forest itself is subject to kind of being grazed down by animals that eat it. That's different than, say, the terrestrial forest. I don't think anything is grazing down the terrestrial forest in Oregon, but in the kelp forests, sea urchins can do that, and that's what you are seeing a lot of times right now in Northern California anyway.
And so the urchins, I've seen pictures of the ocean floor near shore, and it seems like the urchins have taken over and there's no kelp in sight.
Well, they're called urchin barrens because the urchins are there. Having eaten the kelp, what's left is this pavement of coralline algae, like a pink little bit of porcelain on the rocks. And it's a very much lower productivity, not hardly any of the same number of fish or invertebrates that can live there. And so it's a very different environment.
So you mentioned that the report about species extinction pending out last week is primarily a terrestrial thing. When we think about creatures in the ocean, I guess in my mind, they have more hiding places from humans than creatures on land, but are they faring any better?
You know, depends on what creatures you're talking about. There's lots of little things in the ocean, you know, that are not subject to the kinds of pressures that we put on the big things. And unfortunately, hiding places in the ocean have gotten fewer and fewer. Used to be that, fishing fleets didn't go too far from shore, and they didn't get too deep. But now there are fishing fleets all over the ocean. They can fish as deep as the ocean is, thousands of meters down. And the places that critters can go to hide are less and less than they've ever used to be.
Are fishing regulations and management of fisheries having the desired impact? Are some of the fisheries that had been getting low, are they recovering?
You know, that seems to be the case, especially, say, on the west coast of the U.S., California, Oregon, Washington. Big populations of lots of species, like our coastal rockfish, have been returning as the management of those fisheries has gotten better. And there are signs all along the coast of success stories like that. A little bit of care for the ocean allows its natural productivity to boom, and I think we're seeing those results along the coast now.
So a little bit of care, you say, but I mean, does the ocean itself require a lot of care? I mean, as we hear about things like the acidification of the oceans and the warming and things like that?
Yeah, you know, there's two big kinds of things going on. One is the entire climate. So we pump CO2 into the world's atmosphere. That dissolves into the ocean, and it makes it a little more acidic, And then, of course, the CO2 in the atmosphere makes it warmer, and that raises sea level and causes more storms. So these global problems of storms and acidification and sea level rise and heating are everywhere. But we also have a pretty big effect on our local oceans. And this is where communities have learned that they actually have a stake in the health of their local ocean, taking care of things like pollution and runoff and too much development in the wrong places. And overfishing, all those things are communities' tools to help their own local patch of the ocean do better.
Stephen Palumbi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor in marine sciences at Stanford University and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment, also the co-author with son Anthony Palumbi of The Extreme Life of the Sea. He'll be speaking on The Extreme Life of the Sea Friday at 6:30 at the Hales Center at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay, this season's final geology lecture. We seem to get all the geology lecture speakers here on The Exchange. Join us. Questions, comments about things going on in the ocean. Here's your expert, 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen, the mind boggles when I look at some of the images of the exotic creatures in the ocean. Do fish and other animals way down there seem to have evolved from creatures higher up, or is the ocean in essence stratified? Is there much connection between depth?
Yeah, it's a great question. Mostly, I think the critters down in the deep ocean, they're very adapted to being down there, but their ancestors have tended to live in more shallow parts. But some of them are sort of so unusual that we would just never really see them. There's lots of hagfish and lampreys down there, for example. If a whale dies and falls to the bottom of the sea, one of the first kinds of creatures that finds the carcass are hagfish and some sharks, too. So there's critters down there that are living their lives out of sight of us and very, very, very different than what we would normally tend to see. It's also, except for whale falls, there's not a whole lot of food down there. It drifts down slowly in what's called marine snow. And so living in those environments means you're living in the dark and the cold at high pressure and low food. So I think the whole pace of life down there is a little bit slower.
By the way, does our junk get down there? I understand plastic bags have made it all the way to the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Sure. I mean, the junk we put in the ocean gets down there. Plastic as it gets sort of things grow on it and weighs down, and then it tends to fall. But it also tends to break up into these little microplastics that you might have heard about. And they don't fall to the bottom. They are floating around in the whole ocean. We can't expect them to just disappear from sight in the Marianas Trench.
That's an amazing concept, though, with your whale fall when you were talking about that. That, you know, obviously a whale body has to go someplace when a whale dies.
It does, and there's that's just the first stage. These hagfish and sharks come by, and then there's a whole set of bottom-dwelling invertebrates that show up. Things like sea urchins, we usually think of them as being plant eaters, but they show up to chew on the whale carcasses. And then after the flesh is gone, then there are specialized little worms that dig into the bones and live there. So a couple decades after it falls, that whale is gone.
How great is the pressure and the cold down there, way, way down?
Well, the cold is, 2 or 3 or 4 degrees centigrade. So it's not as freezing cold as the Antarctic. But we're pressure-wise, we're talking about, say, 1,000 meters down. The pressure is enormous. And that has two problems that it generates for critters. If you have an airspace in you, like fish have a swim bladder, then that airspace is under pressure when you live down the deep. If you catch a fish that deep and you bring it up quickly to the surface, say on a hook and line, well, the pressure all around it is reduced. And some of the folks listening who are fishermen might have experienced this. You pull this fish up quickly from hundreds of feet down, and its swim bladder then gets so big it pops out its mouth. That is a problem or a reflection of the pressure itself.
So it sounds like, I mean, they've had to evolve, anything that lives down there has to evolve some fairly sophisticated systems to withstand the harsh environment.
It does, and they do have those systems. I mean, they have relatively low metabolisms, but they also have evolved a lot of bioluminescence because there's very little natural light down there, and so a lot of the critters down there make their own light. And then they use that light to see each other, and if you flash your lights too much, then your predators find you and attack you, and if you don't use your lights at all, maybe you can't find your own prey. So it's a constant battle between being a predator and being the prey of something else.
Stephen Palumbi, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor in marine sciences, senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University, talking about the extreme life of the sea this Friday at the Hales Center at SWOC in Coos Bay. Let's take a phone call here from Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I'd like for you to explain to people how the killing of the sea otters for fur 150 years ago then led to the explosion of the sea urchins, which then led to the killing off of many kelp forests, which leads to less productivity in the ocean. We human beings don't seem to understand how things go in steps.
Right. It sounds like you got the whole cycle there. Thank you for the call, Anne. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Stephen? Yeah, Anne, I don't need to explain it. You just did. So one of the things that we found out by sort of just looking into the literature is some of the reasons why otters are so important. They're little animals. They live in very cold water, but they don't have blubber like most marine mammals do. Instead, they have that luxurious fur. And so that meant that they were very, very valuable in the fur trade market, which led to their intense hunting. But also the fact they don't have that much blubber means they have to eat a huge amount, up to about a quarter of their body weight a day. Imagine giving a 60-pound dog 15 pounds of food a day. That's what a sea otter eats. And it's eating urchins and crabs and snails and almost anything you can get. And as a consequence, it's one of the main reasons why sea urchin abundance is kept low. And as Anne says, when you keep the sea urchin abundance low, then the kelp aren't consumed as fast, and the kelp forests can thrive. Those things are called trophic cascades. The most important thing is that what you do at one part of the ecosystem ripples through the other part and affects things that you'd be surprised about, how far the ecological effects of, say, otter hunting have taken us.
So what kinds of protections are there for otters?
Oh, otters are hugely protected. They're endangered species, and so they are protected all up and down the coast in every country. We signed a treaty in 1917 with Russia to protect otters along the whole Pacific Rim, for example. They were thought to be extinct along the California coast until a little population was discovered just south of the Bixby Bridge on the Big Sur coast in California in the middle 1930s. And then strong protection of them allowed that population to expand to what we have now in California.
Is there any reintroduction? Has there been any to help the numbers rebound further? I mean, when you're talking about the situation with the kelp forest and all that depends upon it, it seems like it might be a good idea.
People have tried. Otters have a mind of their own. They're like some dog that you have that just won't eat the food you bought. You can move them to another place to reestablish a population there, and they'll almost, you know, very routinely just move back to where they started from. And then you can decide you want to keep them in their place and just leave them there, and then they'll move someplace else. So the Fish and Wildlife Service has been managing otter populations for the last couple decades, and their ability to control exactly where they live has been pretty low.
Mind of their own. Well, it's good to know for the otters.
they do, yeah.
Let's go from near shore back to the depths, because I want to ask about the anglerfish. How far down does this creature live?
Oh, anglerfish are amazing. You know, they live thousands of feet down. They live down to the sort of middle depths of the ocean. And, of course, they're made famous in the movie Finding Nemo. They sit there on the bottom. They're sit and wait predators, huge mouths. A mouth might be a third of the size of the animal, and it has a little bait that grows from the top of its head on a small pole, really, and that bait is luminescent down in the deep water and attracts small fish who come to check it out, and then the angler fish essentially opens its mouth and gulps them all down.
And I was reading about the adaptation that produces its bait stick. What happened there?
Well, the bait stick is a modified spine on its dorsal fin. And so that is where it came from. But the light itself comes from a little pod of bacteria that live in a small little bump on the end of that rod. It's called the esca. And the bacteria are what make the light in this particular case.
So between the anglerfish, and there are several types of that apparently, and I was looking at the stoplight loose jaw, which looks like a fish wearing some other bigger fish's jaw.
I mean, I know, Jeffrey, this is my favorite one. Thanks. this fish solves the problem of using light to find its own prey without giving away its position, because unlike all the other fish in the deep sea, it makes light that is red. All the other bioluminescence down there is a kind of a blue-green color. So the stoplight loose jaw makes red light, and it beams it out from patches underneath its eyes, both its eyes. And so it has these red headlights that it can go around with and find its prey. But it also is the only fish down there that can see red light. Its eyes have evolved to be able for that fish to see its own light. None of the other fish down there can see red light. So it more or less is free to go around looking for its own food without the fear of giving its position away.
You know, and I think about what it's done with its eyes, and then I look at your work on the sailfish and the stuff that you've revealed about what goes on with its eyes in order for it to be able to see fast as it's chasing prey at 40 miles an hour. What has happened to the eyes of the sailfish?
The sailfish is a really great example of adaptations to an extreme lifestyle. They can swim up to 60 miles an hour. They can feed up to 40 miles an hour. And what they have to do, though, in order to feed that fast is they have to be able to see that fast. Things flash by so quickly at 40 miles an hour that we have a hard time seeing exactly what they were. And their brains and their eyes and those fish are operating at cool ocean temperatures. So in order to make their eyes be able to work fast enough to see things quickly enough to see them when they flash past and turn and gulp them up, the eyes have heaters on the backs of them. And the heaters in the eyes then warm them up to a couple degrees above normal water temperature. And so what's called the retinal flicking rate goes up enough for them to be able to see things flashing past. And then they heat their brains, too. They heat the part of their brain that is where the optical lobes are, the part of the brain that receives the information from the eyes. And that allows their eyes to work and their brains to work at warmer temperatures, and so they can eat fast.
We are learning about some of the creatures of the deep with Stephen Palumbi, a professor in marine sciences and senior fellow with the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. He'll be giving the final geology lecture of the season at Southwestern Oregon Community College Friday at 6:30 on the extreme life of the sea. Got a little time for questions and comments here and now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a video online that I can tell the audience about it that shows Stephen replicating the speed of a sailfish by strapping a sailfish model to the top of a car. Tell me the sound effects were dubbed in. You didn't screech the tires that much, did you?
No. In fact, those are the squealing tires and the engine roar of a Ferrari. But we were desperate. We were basically trying to make this video of how fast fish are, and I really wanted a fast fish video, but I could not find a video of a sailfish moving at 40 miles an hour. I mean, it makes sense. How do you take a video like that? So anyway, we were desperate. I got a stuffed marlin, and we solved the problem.
It was fun. This is your career. It's your work. But can you still be surprised by things in the ocean, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the way you started out this whole segment is how diverse and how different all of these all these creatures can be. And, you know, even now, every year, every month, somebody out there looking at the marine biology of maybe just some kind of normal things finds new things that that are really pretty surprising. It's a great career for young people to go into because there's still so much to find and there's still so much that's valuable to people and still so much that people really wonder at.
You mentioned the stoplight loose jaw from way down as a favorite, but is there one thing in particular you have a fascination with other than that?
You know, that's the trouble with writing books about a subject like this because my fascination is almost like what I've been reading lately. They're just so kind of amazing things. The kinds of things we see right now with whale migration still fascinate me. These are big animals, the biggest animals that have ever lived on our planet, the baleen whales. And they have these incredibly long migrations. Right now here in Monterey, the gray whales are still moving north. They give birth in lagoons in Mexico, and then they swim up our coast and past your coast and past Washington and up through British Columbia and up into the Bering Sea where they feed for the summer. And climate change has meant that their food, which needs pretty cold water, is moving north too. So the whales are moving further and further and further north on longer and longer migrations every year. And that's sort of a fascinating ability of them to continue to find their new food, but it also causes them a problem because now their migration route is thousands of kilometers longer than it used to be.
So a final question is about whale breaching. You describe this in your book. How hard is that?
How hard is it?
Yeah.
Just try to get yourself out of the water. you try it.
I'll try.
I mean, they're huge animals, and they are basically throwing their entire weight out of the water just by swimming fast towards the surface. So it's an amazing feat. And if you've ever seen it or heard it, it's just the most rousing thing. Like, oh my, the magnitude of it is incredible.
It's amazing. The Extreme Life of the Sea, Friday at 6:30 at the Hales Center at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay, spoken by Stephen Palumbi, professor of marine sciences and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. Stephen, thanks.
Hey, Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.